Welcome to episode 2 of the Flat Chat podcast with me, Stuart Codling, powered by F1 Racing Magazine, the latest copy of which landing on subscribers' doormats today. And I have to say it's hugely topical, not just because we're looking forward to the British Grand Prix, which is just about to happen, but the background image to Lewis Hamilton on the front cover is a sort of a monochrome version of the Union flag, looking rather like the stab-proof vest Stormzy was wearing at Glastonbury just this last weekend. So joining me for this epic second edition of the F1 Racing podcast, our regular guest, Ben Anderson, the editor of the magazine and one of the creative driving forces behind this eerily prescient front cover.
Yes, thank you, Codders. Yeah, we're nothing if not culturally astute.
We've been looking into the crystal balls, haven't we? And also joining us, one of our star columnists. We have to say one of our star columnists, because if we just say our star columnist, it puts Ed Straw's nose out of joint, and that's terrible.
But when are you going to have other star columnists on the podcast? Or am I just the only one who's available on a Tuesday morning too?
We were thinking that there might be a sort of a star columnist off. If Ed joins us, then we'll actually have three of our star columnists. And then we'll just need Pat Simmons. Yeah. So
But you're the linchpin, Mark.
I'm the linchpin.
You're the linchpin.
I've never been a linchpin before, but there you go. So it was the first time for everything.
The man who needs no introduction, Mark Gallagher, a business guru, a former commercial chief, team boss, head of Cosworth. If I went through your CV, I'd take up the entire hour or so we've booked this studio for. So let's carry on talking about
Jack of all trades, master of nothing. That might be the way to
fantastic
describe it.
Fantastic way to be.
Star commuter as well, joining us all the way from Oxford today. And if I paint the scene, here we are in the studio. Some of you who are perhaps subscribed to our Autosport sister publications YouTube channel would recognise the sofas we're sitting on from the Three Chumps on Sofas format that proved so popular with the people who criticise our dress sense.
Yeah, we're Three Chumps on the Sofas, but twisted round slightly, aren't we?
Indeed. You'll be pleased to know that we're fully clothed, even though you can't see us, and none of us are wearing too tight trousers or anything else that offends the eye of the YouTube subscribers. So let's talk the mag. Lewis Hamilton, moderately exclusively, has given us his personal memories of all his victories at Silverstone this month, including what drove him to do that crowd surfing moment. Now, Mark, in all your experience being a senior figure in teams, what would have gone through your head if one of your drivers just kind of threw themselves off the pit wall into the crowd?
Probably that they would have been accused of upstaging team boss Eddie Jordan, and that probably would have been the worst thing they could have done. So basically, that would have been welcome, because anything that would have upstaged Eddie would have made a change. I thought it was great that Lewis launched himself into the crowd, and he keeps doing these slightly unexpected. I say slightly unexpected. I don't know why they're unexpected, because he's really good with fans.
Yeah, particularly the British fans.
Yeah, he feeds off them. It's the Nigel Mansell thing, isn't it? That you get an extra few tenths of a second, and plus, you know, he's gunning for that sort of momentous, hopefully sixth home victory this time round.
Yeah, no, it's really good to see that kind of way that he does that engagement, and it is really authentic. You know, because there's not some PR person pushing him saying, go on, Lewis, go on, do
10. A crowd surf.
Go on, do a bit of a thing. I mean, it's genuine. And that's really, and I think that's been another interesting way for us all to learn about the personality that is Lewis Hamilton. You know, what you see is what you get. I think we know that anyway. He wears his heart on his sleeve, but that includes his fan friendliness.
Yeah, it's tricky with Lewis, isn't it? Because he often comes across in print, especially, and sometimes in TV, as slightly misrepresented. Not that people are misrepresenting him, but he can come across publicly in a way that when you've heard him speak live, you think, well, that's not how it sounded. He sounds really genuine. He speaks off the cuff, but it sometimes then gets filtered down and appears almost arrogant. But his, as you say, his relationship with the fans is, I think, genuine. And the feature on the cover of this month's F1 Racing really charts that relationship that, you know, began with his kind of starring GP2 drive in 06, and then builds through his early years, that stunning 2008 victory in the wet, which is one of the greatest wet weather victories in F1. That kind of really launched him, if you like, into the hearts of British F1 fandom. And he's used that relationship, I think, year on year, and especially in the hybrid era, when he's had, you know, the opportunity to go for multiple multiple world championships to really drive himself forward in those battles.
Well, I hope for the sake of our friends who are staying in the F1 racing fan village at Whittlebury Hall that it's not going to be a wet race. certainly for me, because I'm staying in the paddocks there, and it's about 45 minutes walk to the wing from the paddocks.
Long may the heat wave continue. Now that's, and no tight leather trousers for you, Codders.
Well, I try to avoid the tight trousers when it comes to the commute from paddocks to wing, but you never know.
And what are you actually staying in? What are you sleeping in?
Well, it's called the paddocks. It's basically, right. It's kind of like a Butlin-style chalet just inside the gates.
Okay.
A chalet?
Yeah.
Well, you're not
this
really
not
roughing
camping,
it.
Is it?
You're not really roughing it then, are you?
It's more like glamping.
Glamping. Oh,
but
okay.
I'd say it's a step beyond that. It's more like ski holidaying, isn't it?
We will be doing all sorts of stuff for campsite.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Yeah.
Hopefully, well, there'll be a quiz. We have our annual quiz. Hopefully, we will be joined by TV's David Croft to host that. But I can't promise anything. We don't know. He is TBA. Might even be recording a live podcast as well. We last year had one of the World Cup games screened live on our big screen. So hopefully, there'll be something more to entertain the campers. We might even be getting some special guest appearances from drivers, but once again, that's also TBA. We had another guest appearance by another driver in F1 Racing this month for a slightly harder edged feature compared with the soft Lewis one. For those of you intrigued by the nuts and bolts of speed, Lando Norris gave us a very, very, very detailed corner by corner explanation of a fast lap of Silverstone, and that kind of evolved far beyond what we'd originally envisaged for that feature, didn't it, Ben?
Yeah. Lando was very, very insightful about Silverstone for a guy. I mean, obviously he has experience in the junior categories, but a guy has yet to start his first British Grand Prix. I was very impressed with his deconstruction of the circuit, and hopefully that feature lifts the lid on some of the secrets to a fast lap around the track, so when fans are watching the drivers doing what they're doing, they can gain a better insight into how they're making that magic happen. Yeah.
He was really generous with his time as well. I think we were booked in for a 10-minute slot, and he was about 5 or 10 or 15 minutes late arriving for it because his previous interview with a TV channel, not Sky, had run on too long. He was on, I think it was a Spanish TV channel randomly. Maybe they couldn't get Carlos. But
the black hole of scheduling had you twitching,
exactly.
No doubt, Collins.
I was twitching. And in the end, he talked for 45, 50 minutes, and he was really, really making painstaking notes on the stuff we'd printed out for him. So it was totally idiot proof, which was very good, because sometimes he would actually go back on himself and think, I'll explain that corner in more detail. So I sort of had to plot the transcription very carefully against the pen mark. So that was interesting.
He comes across very well, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's been a real emerging star this year, hasn't he? I think both he and George Russell, two new Brits on the scene, it's very encouraging for the British Grand Prix fan base to see those guys doing so well in their respective teams. Okay, they won't be fighting for victory with Lewis on Sunday's race, but there's certainly ones to watch, and Lando and the McLaren doing very well.
George had a very we sort of landed him with a bit of a hospital pass, really, in terms of the content of this issue, where we booked him in for the wellness.
How dare you?
we had him in for our wellness slot, where we went through his meal plan, and it's quite interesting. He likes a good breakfast is the takeaway from this feature. He likes to have a long,
well, he
luxurious...
likes his carbs as well, doesn't he? He has mashed potato with omelette and sweet potato.
And sweet potatoes. And he'll say that he'll have the same meal Friday, Saturday and Sunday of a Grand Prix weekend. That's a soft cooked omelette with mashed potato and roasted chunks of sweet potato, which for a budding bon vivant is a little bit weird. Now, what's your take, Mark, on the carbohydrate and protein balance?
What was yours and Eddie Jordan's favourite lunch options?
I'm looking at this soft-cooked omelette and mashed potato and roasted sweet potatoes and wondering, if I ate that every day, would I weigh 70 kilos like George Russell does? Because that might be the answer to my middle-aged spread, to move on to that. I have to tell you, in Jordan days, it was a full English breakfast or a full Irish breakfast. Yeah. I think the difference is...
in Scotland, it's the haggis, isn't it?
The bacon and the sausages would be sourced from Ireland. There'd be Irish pork and beef and black pudding. And can I tell you, it was one of the secrets... This is a true story. This is one of the secrets to Jordan's PR success. So Ron Dennis used to complain bitterly that Jordan hadn't done anything, but I got all of this press coverage. Well, the answer was that on a Friday morning, every Fleet Street and specialist journo knew that if they came to the Jordan motorhome, wherever we were in the world or came to our hospitality area, be it in Brazil or Japan or whatever, Friday morning, you could have the full English. And that went down incredibly well because people have travelled a long way. They wanted some comfort food. And actually, weirdly, Williams kind of took over that.
So you're now you were the pioneers of what is now known in the paddock as the Williams breakfast.
Exactly. Yeah. So you know, you'd walk into that unit on a Friday morning and there'd be Stan Peacher from The Sun and there'd be Ray Matz from the Daily Mail and there'd be Derek Alsop from the Express and Morris Hamilton from The Independent or whatever. And frankly, by the end of breakfast, they'd had War and Peace from Eddie Jordan on any topic that they would care to think about. He'd probably berated half of them. But actually, it turned into an incredibly simple way to engage with the media and set the agenda for a lot of the topics for the weekend.
Yeah, very smart. Were the drivers also on full Irish, or did they have a slightly different?
To be honest, we didn't really care where they were. I mean, Eddie took very much the Frank Williams plug and play mentality. The drivers are there to drive the car and not really do anything else, you know.
Whatever it is you do,
do it better. That's more the Patrick head, isn't it? Yeah, don't shunt the Jaguar into turn one at Barcelona. Speaking of Williams, of course, our long interview slot this month is with Claire Williams, where she talks about the family business, her background.
The dynasty.
And yeah, the dynasty. I have this very, very peculiar image in my head now of her father glued to the screen watching Dynasty. Apparently they would watch Coronation Street, but her dad thought it was rubbish and he absolutely loved Dynasty.
I'm just trying to imagine Frank and Patrick in built up shoulder pads and sort of Dynasty like gear. I mean, just, you know, the thought of but it's great to find out what it is that makes people switch off, you know. Frank Williams switching off to Dynasty, there you go.
Just the thought of Patrick Head and Frank Williams sitting down together for Dynasty.
Well, Frank, I don't understand the support structure of her shoulder pads.
They've been engineered terribly.
But I wonder if that ever happened. I wonder if Frank ever said to Patrick, listen, mate, what are you doing at the weekend? Do you fancy coming over to watch? Of course, you couldn't really binge watch Dynasty. You had to wait for the next episode, didn't you, coming along?
But, you know, shocking.
Maybe they did. Maybe that's what they did.
Oh, we've missed a trick in the long interview. That Claire does not address that question.
Yeah. Was it Dynasty or was it Dynasty 2, the spin-off series that ended with them being kidnapped by aliens or something?
We were a Dallas family, not a Dynasty.
A Dallas family?
We were a Dallas family, not a Dynasty family.
Dallas was the one where someone woke up and someone who'd not been in the series for
about
18 months.
So Bobby Ewing disappeared. He got killed. He disappeared. And then it turned out that three episodes were actually a dream sequence. Three series were actually a dream sequence. He reappeared.
Three series, wow.
Yeah, and basically the last 3 years turned out to have been a dream. Anyway, they got away with it.
It's absolutely the same character, different actor is what they usually do. Like with these Australian soap operas where one character goes off to the city and comes back played by someone entirely different. Anyway, we're digressing massively and we have quite a short slot in the studio here. So I suppose we should mull the future of the British Grand Prix, which we're previewing this issue of F1 Racing. And until relatively recently, we'd kind of got used to treating every British Grand Prix as if it was going to be the last, and now it's looking as if this one might actually be the last one. There's a sort of a smorgasbord of five races that are coming to the end of their contracts, and given that Vietnam and Holland are pretty much nailed onto their schedule next year, that means two of those five are likely to be dropped. So is it going to be Britain? Is it going to be Italy? Is it going to be Spain, Mexico or Germany?
I have to say that I'm an optimist. I think the British Grand Prix will be fine. I think where we're at now is the 11th hour and the 59th minute of the negotiations, when no one wants to be seen to blink. There's a lot of messaging has been put out there in the last week that it's not going to happen. We have to remember there are some pretty important members of the BRDC who are major broadcasters within Formula One, so they're ideally placed to put messages into the public domain about the fact that Silverstone aren't going to give up on the negotiation. We're not going to blink first. It will be a failure, both by Silverstone and by Liberty, if this deal is not done. And I mean a proper failure of management and leadership if they both fail to do a new contract for what is the home Grand Prix of 7/8 of the teams, depending what way you look at it. And
F1's current most successful driver. You know, if you look at the rise of Max Verstappen and the fact that we now have the Dutch Grand Prix returning as a result of his rise and the fans he's bringing through the gates, we saw, you know, hundreds of thousands of them in Austria. You can't lose the British Grand Prix when you're reigning multiple world champion and biggest single driver personality globally is a British driver.
Do we ever go to the British Grand Prix and see empty grandstands? It never happens. Every time we go to one of these new countries, new territories, where years after they won a Grand Prix, they still don't even fill the grandstands, or in some cases, I've never had one person sit in a grandstand in some of the venues that we go to.
Build the circuit and they won't come.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that far corner of the Chinese Grand Prix circuit has forever been covered with advertising hoardings.
I mean, Sepang. I mean, we went to Malaysia in 1999, and I remember looking at these amazing grandstands out in the far distance and thinking, that's going to look amazing when they're filled with people. I never saw anyone ever sit in them. The main grandstand opposite the pits, they sold the tickets to that. Some of the further grandstands just never had anyone in them. British Grand Prix is a huge commercial success. Sell out every year, one of the biggest sporting events this country puts on, highly knowledgeable fan base, exactly as you say, Ben, the superstar Formula One is British. It will be a complete failure for both parties if they don't get this deal across the line, and they need to do it, and they need to do it soon.
Says a lot about how expensive it is to host a Grand Prix, that even though it sells out every year, and the tickets aren't cheap, let's face it, that they'd calculated that within a couple of years it was going to become unsustainable.
Yeah, hence why they've committed this act of self-harm, if you like, by exiting the deal. I mean, they had a deal for the race sewn up for many years to come, didn't they? But on this classic Bernie escalator, that meant by 2023, I think it was, they were going to be spending $25 million a year to host the race, and they couldn't do that. So
I love the fact that Bernie's now chipping in to say, we've got to keep the British Grand Prix at Silverstone.
With a wink.
With a wink. And a big Bernie wink, exactly.
To my mind, this whole scenario, and also a lot of other things that have been happening at Silverstone, show how effective the management of that circuit is these days. It used to be kind of a little bit blazery, a little bit BRDC, old duffery, but to my mind, Stuart Pringle is kind of like a quietly underestimated figure. He seems like a pretty tough negotiator. He comes across as being quite genial, but I think he's ex-services, isn't he? He didn't just fall out of the tree yesterday. He seems to be able to get stuff done. For instance,
well, you did an interview with him.
Yeah,
for last F1 year, Racing last year, didn't
in Barcelona, and you know, he's very amiable, but you get the impression that he kind of knows what he wants to get out of a deal and won't budge from it. But he doesn't kind of go in. He's not a Trump style, guns blazing.
Bellicose.
I'm going to ask for a ridiculous deal and then I'm going to step back from it. He sort of quietly lays out what he wants and he makes it happen. So,
and Silverstone's also diversifying, isn't it? Pringle mentioned, I think it was in Bahrain earlier this year, that they're, you know, they've got this, they've got other centres around the site already, but they've got
the new Silverstone experience.
Got new innovation centres opening up. They're attracting businesses. They've got, you know, plans in for this hotel that they want to construct opposite the wing, which is not linked to the race. It's actually meant to be for business conferences and other things. So they realise that, you know, for so long the circuit's business has been built around the Grand Prix. That in itself is not a sustainable business, even I think if they renegotiate this deal successfully. So they need to diversify and make that site a sustainable site with or without Formula One.
Mm. They've also got the track resurfaced again, which is another interesting little wrinkle that maybe our listeners, readers, subscribers won't be aware of, that last year Silverstone was resurfaced. And
well, they got Lewis, didn't they?
Yeah, they got Lewis. No one was very satisfied with the resurfacing, least of all the people who had to race on it. There was the absolute farce of the MotoGP round in the wet, and they basically got the company in to redo it. And behind the scenes, Mr. Pringle kind of basically got this company in a headlock and negotiated for them to come back and redo it.
Well, it remains to be seen if the job's been done. But I mean, it's a hard job, isn't it? Because the Formula One cars now are faster than ever, certainly over, you know, a single lap, heavier than ever. The forces are huge, and that's a lot for the track surface to bear. So Well, yeah, you have to up your game in all areas, don't you?
Well, the contractor that they brought in, one of the directors of that company, lives in my village, and I had a pint with him a couple of weeks ago, and they're very pleased with the result. And they said it's been a lot of high pressure to get it right because of the nervousness of, and he mentioned Stuart Pringle obviously feels the burden of responsibility to get it right. He said the issues of last year were the runoff for any water, the runoff was not correctly put in place. That's been addressed. So they've been literally shaving, in some cases, he said, millimetres off just to make sure every if there is any rain, it runs off. There isn't going to be standing water. And they address all of those issues that arose before. And also the mixture of the tarmac in terms of the oil, proportion of oil that's within it, all of the all of those things. So quite interesting to talk to somebody who's not actually a racing fan, but just looks at it purely as a civil engineering project. And he said there's been a huge amount of effort gone into getting it right.
I hope it's going to be a really, really good race. I mean, last year's British Grand Prix was very entertaining, wasn't it? So that's what we hope. If it's going to be the last one, hopefully, and it's not going to be the last one, but if it is, that hopefully they can go out on a bang.
Shall we move on to the state of the racing? Austria, it was...
Is that a neat segue?
We've had what we can describe as an exciting and intriguing Austrian Grand Prix, but it was kind of an outlier in a season that's been kind of... It's been a very one-note season. It's been dominated
exciting
by
exciting and intriguing.
Team.
It was brilliant.
Am I understanding it?
I was genuinely buzzing after watching that race.
It was pretty incredible, but shall we weigh that against the French Grand Prix debacle? With the elephant in the room, really, with the Austrian Grand Prix, is that it was a one-stop race, like, for most competitors. For the people who for whom it became a two-stop race, it was
rolling the dice, wasn't it?
Yeah. And it didn't work. So we're not kind of out of the woods yet. Now, Mark, in your column, you've tackled the issue of how the top teams are using data to de-risk, which is a word I hate, but I've just used it, so kill me now. Basically, using data to deliver as predictable an outcome as possible. You liken it to basically ordering something on Amazon and it turning up, and that is exactly how they package and
that's
deliver a
want.
Race.
That's what they want. If they don't, and you actually see that, I think, in the body language. If Mercedes-Benz doesn't get pole position, doesn't win the race, they look almost bemused.
How have we miscalculated this so badly?
And that's something that started during the Schumacher era, where they went into a race knowing they'd win, and if they didn't win, there was something odd had happened. As I'm not a data scientist for the column, I telephoned a friend of mine, Neil Martin, who is a data scientist who came into Formula One with McLaren. He was actually going to work in the city in banking as a trader and build software for predicting trading patterns in the city. So he basically took that kind of predictive analytics capability, and instead of using it to make hundreds of millions in the city, he used it to shave hundreds of a second off performances in Formula One. Joined McLaren, went from McLaren to Ferrari to Red Bull, was head of strategy at Ferrari. An incredibly clever guy. And the more I talked to him, the more I realized that, you know, the science behind this means that teams are no longer on a journey of uncertainty. They're on a journey of knowledge. I mean, I'm going to just crib from the column here. I mean, he said to me, the only thing that really goes
You're allowed
wrong,
to plagiarise yourself.
Okay, I can plagiarise myself. I mean, he said, literally, once we do those algorithms, once we crunch all those numbers, we're then in the hands of human error for things to go wrong. So basically, a pit stop blunder, the tyres aren't in the right place at the right time, as we saw in Austria. A strategy error where some aspect of the variables hasn't been calculated properly. Grid penalties. Driver errors in qualifying, you know, driver shunting, going off track, whatever. Safety cars, which, you know, a wet race, the good old Bernie Eccleston, we need sprinklers to mix things up. He's actually not wrong about that. Or if you've, for whatever reason, gone for an incorrect tyre choice because maybe you haven't had sufficient data from practice and you've gone the wrong way. But the point Neil made is even those things over which it looks like we don't have control, we actually have a pretty good idea of how to deal with them. So, for example, this is why going into a race and knowing that there's a 65% chance of a safety car based on previous races, that becomes a known known. You have a you build that into your calculation. So actually, I mean, Neil's a huge racing fan, but as a scientist, he deals in certainty. And so
and
he
that's
doesn't
anti-racing, isn't
he? He doesn't want unpredictability. And in fact, the very first thing he said to me when I called him about this was, he said, "Mark, I don't know why people whinge and bitch about predictability in Formula One." He said the whole sport is based around predictable outcomes. The fastest car starts first. Why does anyone think it's a surprise that that car doesn't get overtaken? He said the whole thing is predicated on predictability. I asked him, how do we mix things up? And he didn't have an answer to that because he said, you know, we've got the science that we've got.
I do.
Computer says no.
Take the data away. They should be flying blind on the race weekends. You mentioned one of the you know, the areas that throws in unpredictability being lack of data for the tyres. And we've seen a couple of editions of the US Grand Prix at Austin where Friday, Saturday has been washed out by storms. So they've done absolute minimal running. They've just about qualified, but done no actual running on the various compounds of slick tyre, gone into the race, maybe mixed condition start or even dry, not knowing what to do. And you get teams trying all sorts of different things. Oh, we'll try the softest, we'll go on the hardest tyre, because they don't know. And you've ended up having, in context of a fairly predictable season, a brilliant mixed up race. If you take away the data, I'm not saying they can't have the data, maybe, you know, you give it to them at the end of the weekend so they can evolve the cars, etc. It is theirs. But strip these sensors away, strip the data off the cars for the race weekend, and then you've got to fly blind, haven't you? It becomes then a much more intuitive exercise. And plus you've got the simulations being done back at base. You've got this virtual testing going on the Fridays with Esteban Ocon in the Mercedes simulator, you know, trying to work through all these extra setup options. Of course it's going to be predictable if you're allowed to do
all
this.
That's become another arena of inequality, hasn't it? Where you have the teams that can spend big because there's less on-track testing.
Having mission control.
Yeah, mission control simulators. Yeah. Whereas Alfa Romeo still don't have a simulator. And you kind of think...
Has have gone from something like 3 blokes to maybe 10 or 12 over the last few years, realising that this is an area where they're massively behind compared to the top teams.
I sometimes wonder how much fun it would be if the real-time telemetry data was only provided to the fans and spectators and media and not to the driver, so that we actually all know that Lewis Hamilton has got a fourth gear problem and
he doesn't
and actually the hydraulic pressure is dropping, or
a bit of dramatic irony in Formula 1, you know, that'd be fantastic, wouldn't
mind
it?
Mind you, knowing Liberty, they'd probably want to put some dramatic music on top of that, wouldn't they?
yeah I mean, I think it there's a, there is I a think the data thing is really interesting, because I do think that the drivers should make all the decisions once the lights go out. And then now and again you get something like Austrian Grand Prix, absolutely amazing race. I was on the edge of my seat watching that race, and you realise that maybe if Max Verstappen hadn't had the call from his engineer to say, you need to do a reset, you know, fail 3, reset, maybe he wouldn't have finished that race. Maybe he would have a problem that got worse and we wouldn't have had that amazing result. So sometimes...
It helps,
maybe it helps.
Yeah. Also, there's an interesting, I think, flip side to this absolutely data-managed process, in that teams get so beholden to it. It's a bit like the old McLaren weather radar that used to outfox them consistently in the mid-noughties. Maybe we saw it at Monaco with Ferrari, you know, not running Leclerc again in Q1. They get so beholden to their predictions. This is going to be the cut-off time. We're safe. This is what we predict is going to happen. That when they don't read the actual circumstances of what's going on, and suddenly they emerge stupefied.
Yeah, and they're panic all of a sudden.
Slumber, going, oh, how is it possible that we miscalculated this? And it's just because they're not doing the good old fashioned thing of licking the finger and sticking it up in the air and just reading what's in front of you.
Well, paradox of automation, isn't it?
Next month is the 20th anniversary of Jordan winning the French Grand Prix, and we won the French Grand Prix in 1999 because our motorhome driver, Dave, had been sent into a field 2 kilometres away to watch for the rain, and he was able to radio in, and he was our human early warning system. And I remember when we won that race and Ron Dennis came down to sort of congratulate the team. And
Probably grudgingly.
He must have been furious that not only are you getting so much PR and attention from the press,
but actually
nothing,
managed to win a race as well. Actually won a race, which was quite nice. But he kind of was like, well, how did you guys manage to do that? You know, where did you get this? You know, what sort of data system did you have? Well, the data system was
which
called
where
Dave.
The system company do
you know,
use?
Exactly. You know, well, actually it's Dave and he's serving the coffee, you know. So the human aspect. I do agree with you that they sometimes go down the rabbit hole of data to a point where you want to pull them all back and say, you got to combine that data with human insight and experience and sometimes a bit of gut feel as well.
Yeah, but ultimately, you know, you're right in your column in that, no, 9 times out of 10, these calculations are accurate, and that is what kills the unpredictability we want to see. Fortunately, in Austria, I think you had the combination of probably 5 things. The heat, the hottest summer on record, isn't it, at the moment in Europe. The altitude, which is a big strain, and obviously Mercedes really struggled with the combination of altitude and
temperatures. Yeah, it was the lift and coast that killed their race, wasn't it?
And that leads to the quickest car, quite comfortably the quickest car on balance this season, not being the quickest. So that instantly you're in for a more edifying spectacle, shall we say. And then you've got the track layout.
Not enough slow corners for the Merc to do its stuff.
And also a short circuit, so the gaps between the cars are already going to be smaller because there's just less physical room to stretch out your performance advantage. And an old school type of circuit with nasty curbs, some gravel traps, some close barriers. So there's genuine punishment if drivers make mistakes. Whereas at Paul Ricard, you've got a track that people have done to death. They've got all the data. They've got masses of runoff. The corners are, apart from a few chicanes, it's just easy fast sweeps, if you like, and long straights. Not challenging enough and not conducive to an exciting race.
Yeah. Funny, isn't it, that a circuit that most people think is a little bit pony seems to deliver consistently good races in a way that circuits that were more scientifically designed perhaps don't.
And even though it's not the old Osterreich ring anymore, it has got undulation. Now, every corner, you're either approaching uphill or downhill. You've got a mix of fast, slightly blind corners and slow ones.
The odd orange smoke screen.
3 DRS zones to help keep people bunched up.
Yeah, the three DRS zones definitely helped. And also with like Austria, also you have that, I'm sorry, but it's incredibly simple. You've got nice long straights into really slow corners where you can throw the car down the inside, the outside. You can try different lines. You can dummy. It's not rocket science, really. And so a track that is very short and actually not that exciting, but it has those basic ingredients that any track needs in order to unlock some excitement.
So Adrian Newey's right, basically, when he says it's about the track design.
Yeah, he's not wrong.
Get the track design right and you can have a great race. But also you need great drivers doing incredible things and having things go slightly wrong. You know, what really made the race was Max Verstappen shonking the start and then somehow unbelievably coming back through to win. You know, it was one of the greatest drives I think I've seen in Formula 1 in the dry.
And that late pit stop helped him, which meant that on that second set of tyres he could go for it, and he really went for it. And it was so thrilling to watch this unstoppable force, and you're thinking he isn't really going to overtake the Mercedes. Actually, he is.
Yeah,
he's just going to keep coming. And I mean, when he got into second,
can he do it?
Oh. I looked at the when he got into second place, I was looking at the gap to the lead and thinking, "Wow, really? You know, And I was looking at the lap times and thinking, "Wow, he's going to catch him. You know, but is he going to get past him?" And then it just became so obvious that it was. Leclerc wasn't going to be able to do anything to stop Max coming through. It was so exciting. If we could only have, exactly to your point, it's kind of the one-off exciting race. And
this one we desperately needed, wasn't it?
We desperately needed, but the trouble is I really hope we don't have to wait another 7 races before we have another spellbinding event like that.
The problem really is that kind of Formula 1 at the moment is kind of sewn up by 3, arguably 2 teams, and next month we are going to be looking at Renault's consistently frustrated and frustrating attempts to break into that kind of leading group. This issue, we hung out with Daniel Ricciardo at a roadshow in Nice to promote the recently passed French Grand Prix. A lot of people have questioned his motives for moving to Renault, and he's just had a milestone birthday, the magic 30.
Ooh.
Yeah, oh dear. I remember my 30th birthday. And we had a chat in the car on the way to Nice about...
What was your 30th birthday like, before we move on too quickly?
My 30th birthday, I had a month's worth of celebrations featuring a rolling cast of guests
our flat.
A month's
sounds like
worth
Sir
of
Louis
celebrations.
Louis XIV, Versailles royalty extravaganza. You know. Was there a national holiday called?
A month of feasting in Farnham.
Feasting in Crystal Palace, actually. It was before we moved to Farnham. Okay. So, yeah, you would
I do apologise.
You would not believe how many people you can squeeze into a two-bedroom flat in Crystal Palace on a rolling basis. Fortunately, the neighbours didn't complain, or if they did, we didn't hear them. But
I wonder if Daniel Ricciardo had a month of feasting.
He's a flat dweller, and it was interesting to speak to him about various aspects of the way his career is shaped up. And I even asked him, as a flat dweller and as an Australian who's no doubt a fan of barbecues, what it is like to live in a space where you are not allowed to have a barbecue. What's it actually like to live in Monaco? You know, those of us who come once or twice a year, it's this strange place with roads like a plate of spaghetti and high-rise living. I mean, you live in apartments. Presumably, as an Australian, you must love your barbecues. What's it like living in a place where you're probably not allowed to have a barbecue?
Yeah, that's the biggest thing. Coming from Oz, like we're used to homes and backyards and space. That's one thing you don't get in Monaco. So, I mean, the apartment living is, it's a bit of a change. But in saying that, you know, we probably spend more nights in a hotel room than anything else, you know, and that's been my life the last probably 10 years. So I guess I'm not used to living in a home as such, full time anymore. But yeah, I mean, if I was here 365 days a year, I'd probably get a bit claustrophobic because I do need my space and to kind of get out. But yeah, I mean, it's, as you said, the coastline's beautiful, the roads are amazing. So when the weather's, I keep referring to weather, as you can tell I am Australian and I need sunshine to function. So when it is above 20 degrees, it is a great place to be and to get out and train and whatever. And there is a good little network of people here. But I'd say the downside is most of that network is racing drivers, and you kind of get bored talking about race cars all the time. So it is nice to sometimes get out and mingle with different people from different areas of life. But it's been good. I've been here nearly 6 years now.
When you were a kid, growing up, presumably dreaming about getting into Formula One, yeah. was this kind of what you expected, or were you just thinking about the business of driving the cars? You hadn't sort of thought about what the lifestyle accoutrements would be like?
Yeah, I had no idea. I guess I had no idea, and I didn't plan it or think of what it was going to be like. You know, it was just race cars, and even then it wasn't about race cars to, you know, make good money, or it was never really about that. It was just about going fast and wanting to be the best. And F1 in my head wasn't about the lifestyle, it was about these guys are the best in the world, so try and be there and see if you're the best, basically. And now obviously once you're in it, and then it starts becoming your living. It is obviously my job, which I make my revenue from. It's I don't know, it's pretty crazy. It still kind of feels weird, obviously in a good way, but you need, like, I can definitely see how probably in any sports, you know, people could maybe get a bit sidetracked or lost along the way, because there is, I guess, the distractions that come with it, whether it's the people you meet or maybe the money you make. But yeah, having kind of my close friends around me, and when they come to races, all that, I don't know, you need good people close to you to kind of keep you grounded. But yeah, living in Monaco, it sounds funny because it's, people think you're not really staying grounded when you're living here. It is a pretty crazy place, but yeah, you're just gonna just be real if you can.
It's a tricky business. Do you have to import your mates from Australia then?
I mean, I definitely encourage them to come to races just because I like having them around, and it's certainly a good time. But also, you know, don't get me wrong, I do like exploiting some of the opportunities I've got now. Like it's, I think it would be silly not to, because it is also a privilege and, as I said, an opportunity to probably do more with your life in a way. But fortunately, I'm still very driven, and like, big picture for me is still, I want to be the best and world champion. And yeah, it's not just about, okay, now I want to race just to make enough so I can go and live somewhere nice. Like, it's, I don't know, there's still a lot for me to achieve, and that's always been first and foremost.
What are your earliest memories of watching motor racing? Was there stuff going on near you? Were you watching it on TV and sort of wishing you didn't live in Perth and maybe lived in Melbourne, Adelaide, that sort of thing?
I was really involved from as young as I can remember. Dad was racing a bit around Australia, more locally, but I was, you know, growing up at racetracks and on the weekends, and there's pictures of, you know, mum carrying me with little earmuffs on and watching dad, so it was always in front of me. And you know, then on TV it was always on, but that was normally by my choice. You know, I was just wanting to watch everything I could, and two wheels, four wheels, all of it, NASCAR, everything really. So yeah, and I was fascinated with a Wayne Gardner documentary when I was a kid. We went back to the video store, I reckon every 2 weeks, to rent it out, and I think it was his world champion year. I'm probably going to blow this. It might have been 89 or something. I'm probably wrong with the date, but anyway.
Well, you know, it won't be far wrong, I think.
Yeah, it's close. Yeah. It's close. And I watched that a bunch. So it was, yeah, like Formula One was just what I wanted to do, but I was in love with it all.
What about Mick Doohan? Because he never made the transition to four wheels, but his son has.
Yeah, Jack's doing well, and Mick was another hero, I guess. And really any Australian that was on a world level, it was, I think, just Australians always respected Australians, and so yeah, Mick did it, and I've obviously got to meet him, you know, the last few years, and that's been cool. And that's probably the crazy thing now, is that the people I'm meeting and even sometimes hanging out with, it's like, wow, like I was watching you on TV, and even like as a kid I might have met some of them as a fan, and obviously they didn't know me at the time, and it's just like, I don't know, it's crazy how one day they're signing an autograph for you, and you know, a few years later you're kind of having dinner with them or something. It's pretty bizarre.
Do you now feel that kind of you've got a duty when you're out there, not just in Australia but Grand Prix around the world, that you've got to do that autograph signing because you're inspiring the next generation almost, aren't you?
Yeah, it's something I've only really probably realised or understood the last maybe 2 years, I guess, since I've started to get a bit older, and I understand I'm not a young kid anymore. I'm 30 this year, so I guess I'm in a position now where kids will look up to me, and also the kids that are looking up to me probably aren't a threat for my career because I'll probably be done by the time they make it, so I could afford to give them a bit of time and not feel I have to keep too much in. But yeah, like it's kind of like having eyes in the back of your head, like you want to be aware of kind of what you're doing in a way, and because yeah, it's at the end of the day you want to do what's right for you, and you know, the sport is a selfish one, and I'm here because I want to be the best and all that. But if you can still do it in a way that is not setting any bad examples, then that's good. And it is nice, like, you get a little kid that comes up to you and they're like starstruck, and they're just like, oh my gosh, like I started go-karting because of you, or you know, I started drinking out of my shoe because of you. you know, that's actually kind of nice. And little things like that, especially you notice it when you're not having a good day or a good weekend. That's when it's like, wow, okay, I'm gonna keep plugging away at this.
You know, sometimes you might not necessarily know what to say to someone famous when you, I don't know, about standing by them at a coffee machine. I remember once waiting behind Paddy Hopkirk, the old rally driver, at some Silverstone do, and I said to him, oh Paddy, I've got one of your bike racks in my garage. So maybe in a few...
He's probably like, all right, well, good for you.
Which about what he said. What was the thinking behind your kart brand? Because obviously in a few years' time, you're going to people say, I raced your karts when I was a kid.
Yeah, that was... So basically the first... the first thing that went off when my friend Michael kind of brought me the idea was how cool my own go-kart, and that was literally the initial thinking. It was, this is where it all started, and I've seen, you know, some other drivers over the years. I mean, I've driven Trulli karts and some other drivers branded karts, and I was just like, I never thought that would be me. And then I was like, I actually now have an opportunity to do this, and I was like, that's awesome. So and it's there's a bit of obviously like nostalgia to it. As I said, it's where it all began, so it kind of in a way keeps you in touch with where it all started and your roots, and it kind of weirdly brings you back down. So that's, and I'm not saying in a completely positive way, it just kind of reminds you of the journey. So that was where it all started. And we went to do the whole like European World Championship stuff and tried to kind of do the real race team thing and be successful with that. But like, I guess all things, if you're trying to get to the top, you need to invest all your effort into it. And you know, I was going to some races, but I couldn't give all my time, you know, that was the truth, because of obviously I was trying to do, well, I'm still trying to do my best on the F1 track. So we'd done a little bit of a different thing this year, and we started like a Daniel Ricciardo series, and it's actually based in the UK. So it's like a one make series, it's kind of like a low cost series, so it's more encouraging entry level carters to get started, and I think that's actually going to be more fulfilling than kind of just having already a kind of top driver winning in your kart.
Now, you said you've been a lot busier over the past couple of years. Do you actually get to many other races now? Have you got any plans to go to anything?
So I've always got plans to go to them, but sometimes the sad truth is that when you have a free weekend, the last place you want to be is a racetrack. So it's tough, because I still love it, and I know that if I did get out to one, you know, like, so a MotoGP, I've been trying to get to, you know, Misano, Rossi's home one for the last few years, but by that stage of the season as well, I'm tired, and it's like, I think it's the week before Singapore, and Singapore's one of the toughest races of the year, and it's like, oh, I should be really being at home training, and it's more travel, and it's, so it's, unfortunately, there's always an excuse to not be there, but if you do go, it's awesome. So I did the Karting World Champs a couple of years ago. That blew my mind how much the sport has grown, and it was literally a mini F1 paddock. But yeah, things like MotoGP and that, I definitely want to get to. NASCAR. I finally did a NASCAR race, actually, the end of 2017 in Texas, and I loved that. So I'm slowly ticking them off. But yeah, it's schedules. It's tough.
It is tough.
How's your arm going?
It's fine. Right? Holding this incredibly heavy piece of equipment. Well, I did once have to spend 45 minutes lying at Gary Newman's feet holding a microphone. So
anything's easy now.
Anything's possible when you've lain at Gary Newman's feet for 45 minutes.
I'm
going to
act like I know who Gary Newman is. I'm sorry if I've offended Gary Newman. Should I know you, Gary?
He had two number ones in the 1970s.
Oh, he's a singer?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, some people might describe him as a singer.
All right.
Thank you very much, Daniel.
No worries.
So yeah, that was quite a meandering chat there, and I'm glad he picked up on the difficulty of holding the giant chalk ice, as we call the high quality recording device, when it's perched between you, and you kind of get a slight cramp in the elbow. And Ben,
so you need fitness then, do you? You need some training for this.
As you'll find out, Ben, when you take the high quality recording device on the road. The other interesting takeaway from that is that he's kind of laughing and joking around in that piece, he does say with great determination that he still wants to be a world champion. He's not just kind of taking the money and doing it for the lifestyle. He views this as a long-term move, and he has faith in the Renault project to get back to the front.
Seems slightly misplaced, doesn't it, in the context of happening in Austria?
That we don't know.
Yeah, I was going to say, you've had scepticism written all over your face through that.
Yeah, I feel very torn about the whole Daniel Ricciardo thing, because who doesn't like Daniel? I mean, he's a super guy.
Great.
He's an outstanding driver. I actually, one of the other things about watching the Austrian Grand Prix and watching Max coming through that field, I was thinking, how much would Daniel Ricciardo have loved to have been doing that and executing some of those overtaking manoeuvres? And he was, well, running around in the midfield. My gut feel is that, together with his manager, the sort of fear factor of staying in the Max Verstappen camp overwhelmed him. The lure of potential number one status at Renault and a lot of money was a big attraction. It looks like a little bit too early of a cash-in on his career. And at the age of 30, he must surely know that the next 3 years were always going to be it. And is he going to win the World Championship in the next 3 years with Renault? And the answer at the moment would seem to be no, because they're not even the fastest Renault engine car.
No, that's quite a shocker, isn't it?
They're being outperformed by their customer, aren't they? I mean, Daniel said in his cover interview he did with us for April's issue that his faith was that Renault, with everything they were doing, they were going to get to the front quicker than the Honda project would. So regardless of all the other things, I mean, you know, he says it's not about the money. Obviously, we know it's partly about the money. It's all these things tied together. But he was not as convinced by the information Red Bull were getting from Honda last year that convinced them to do the deal as Max was. But now it looks like that faith has been misplaced. Max has convincingly won a race with Honda power. And okay, he lapped his teammate Pierre Gasly, who's having a nightmare in the sister car. But you feel confident that even if, terrible pun, banned, even if we accept that, you know, Red Bull Honda is now really Max Verstappen's team and Ricciardo would be the second driver, you've got to feel that he would be doing a stronger job than Gasly is at the moment. And he would be getting better results and having a better time on track if he was in the Red Bull Honda than the Renault. But that said, the psychology of being in a team that you feel is already moving away from you and towards the other driver. He can't go to Ferrari, that's Vettel's team. You know, Leclerc's got to go through a process of trying to outperform Sebastian to take number one status. Hamilton, even if the contracts don't say, so he's number one driver at Mercedes, isn't he, since Nico Rosberg left. So what does Daniel do? He's either got to be number two to Max, or he's got to try and go somewhere where he can be number one and have the full support, if you like, even if it's, you know, slightly seeing snipers, as you would say, Mark, of the team. And Renault, he can get that, and it probably was at the time the best bet to go for outside of the big three. But now obviously McLaren coming back through, they look like the best of the midfield teams. Which one of those two gets to break through into the big three, or any of them, we can't say yet. But it doesn't look like he's going to be world champion, like you say, in that time frame, certainly not.
It kind of makes me think about Gerhard Berger. So Tanabe San, who's the technical director of Honda, he first worked in Honda's F1 program on Gerhard Berger's McLaren Honda back in 1990. And Berger used to be asked about, you know, being teamed with Senna. And he used to say, well, I want to drive the best car in Formula One. And if I happen to be teamed with the guy who turns out to be the man of this era, that's not a bad place to be, because on the day that he doesn't win, I know I'm going to win, and I do think on the odd occasion I can do it. And Berger gave that advice to Eddie Irvine when Irvine went to Ferrari with Michael Schumacher. He said to Eddie, sure, it's going to be pretty miserable some of the time, but actually you're also going to get those wins and those victories, and by the way, you'll also be earning quite good money and driving a properly competitive car. And so being the number two driver in the best team in the world isn't actually that negative a space to be in.
Eddie Irvine would have been the least impressive world champion ever if he'd got across the line in 99, wouldn't he?
I don't know about that, actually, because I mean,
are you going to say Denny Hulme?
No, I mean, the thing about Eddie was that he had this almost James Hunt kind of image with some people within this sport, and there were a lot of fans loved what Eddie stood for, and I mean, I think if he'd won that, it would have been so interesting if he had won that championship. The fact that he didn't really just pulled the rug from under the feet of his reputation, if that is an expression that I can use. I mean, your reputation.
Our star columnists mix the metaphors.
Mixing metaphors is a speciality. So I think the very fact that Eddie didn't clinch it, you know, it just, from that moment on, everything just washed away, because in Michael Schumacher breaking his leg in the British Grand Prix that year, the championship was on a plate for Eddie.
But even Ferrari didn't want him to win it, did they?
No.
Tire gate at the Nürburgring. I mean, Vettel knows how he feels. Maybe the computers just got it wrong. Maybe the message didn't come through in time.
Yeah.
Well, I think Vettel's got a right to be aggrieved at the moment, has it? Nothing seems to go right for him, does it? You know, the tire farce in Austria, the slightly controversial stewarding decision in Canada. I suppose just as Flat Chat brings the magazine to a conclusion, let's go through my column this month. We do tackle that controversial, that we grasp that particular thorn, which is stewarding. And my take on the Canada thing is that people formed a pitchfork mob demanding consistency in stewarding decisions, and that's why under Jean Todt the stewarding decisions have been absolutely to the letter, haven't they, of the law. There's been no fudging, no grey areas. It has been just interpreted according to the laws, so people are basically getting what they've asked for. Now the guy who came up to me in the wake of Canada, Tony Tobias, and said, well, do you know, they should have just let Sebastian had it, because it worked for it, so do you know, it's time for someone else to win. And I said, well, that's not really in the steward's bailiwick, is it? They don't get to decide who should win based on sentiment. It's all about the letter of the law. And if we're going to let them race, as people now say we should, they have to be prepared for there to be occasional inconsistencies or grey areas.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't disagree with you.
Oh, good.
The letter of the law was applied in Canada, wasn't it? However you feel emotionally about, you know, a great race and Ferrari finally getting a win and all of Vettel's theatrics afterwards, he went off the track and he rejoined unsafely. He rejoined into the path of another car, and the other car had to take evasive action. To the letter of the law, that's a penalty. So you can say that the law needs to be rewritten, but then the consequence of that is that people will start pushing drivers off the track, unless you can trust that all the drivers will rein themselves in. But they won't, because they'll do everything they can to push the envelope, just like Max did subsequently in Austria. You know, needless contact on the exit of that hairpin. It was a brilliant drive. But if he could have just done that move cleanly, we wouldn't be talking about F1 stewarding anymore. But yet again,
it was the little biff, wasn't it?
Yet again, it will dominate. And okay, in the end, they chose not to penalise, but I think they could have done. And I wonder how much the furore over Canada and how far that dragged on into France was in the back of the minds of the stewards when they were coming to judge that incident. Because the clerk, okay, it's not the same incident. It's not a going off and rejoining. So what Massey said, the race director, about it being apples and oranges is fair. It's two guys going into the corner, contesting position. They know what they're doing. Leclerc tries wall of death, hanging on around the outside like he did before. Second time around, the space wasn't the same, and they clashed. So you can probably say, well, it can go either way. In the end, they've opted to go for the leave it alone way, but had Canada not happened, would they have actually applied a much harsher approach, if you like, to judging that incident? I'm not sure.
Well, as you say, I mean, they're only human, and we all get affected by the things that are happening around us. I've thought long and hard about what happened in Canada and then again in Austria, and a kind of takeaway for me is I think we should just have one referee, not three stewards. And I think the referee should have to make a decision within 5 minutes of an incident. Just like a referee in football, you're either right or you're wrong. If you're wrong, you know, you're wrong. The referee made the call, just get on with it. You know? I think the other thing is that the incident in Austria, Leclerc was straight on the radio. Like, what just happened? I would love to see the drivers realise that if they come on the radio and plead for a foul, if it turns out that it's just gamesmanship, there should be some cost to them for doing that. Make them think twice.
Dissent. Yellow card for dissent.
It's actually dissent. So, yeah. Because actually what they're doing is stirring the pot when actually we want them to get on with racing.
Yeah. They all do it, don't they? Lewis did it as well in Canada.
And I know it's become part of the professional process.
You it's
know,
like diving for a penalty, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Well, actually.
Simulation.
Yeah. That and the way that Leclerc took that corner, I kind of thought that if, say, what we might describe as the Canada approach had been employed, you would tend to get drivers now, when they're being overtaken, putting themselves in that position where they can't help but be nudged off. And that is kind of like a professional foul, isn't it? It's like diving in football, isn't it?
It's like, yeah, where can I go? Whereas, of course, actually, I think the key thing here is probably precedent. So in Canada, you had the very recent precedent of Verstappen and Raikkonen in Japan at the chicane, led to a 5-second penalty. So, ergo, the same thing has to apply. Vettel's gone off the track, he's rejoined and forced another car off the track, or, you know, over the white line against the wall. In the Leclerc case, he's basically just been run out of road on the exit by the guy who's overtaken him. And that happens constantly in all forms of racing and in Formula One at various tracks, and never is even investigated. So if you take precedent, there's no reason to apply a penalty in the Leclerc Verstappen case, because Leclerc should realise the position's gone. Max has got the move done in the middle of the corner by not turning in as early as he did the previous lap. Leclerc's mistake is leaving the door open in the first place. He should accept that the circumstances are different to the previous lap, where he hung on around the outside and got the run down the next straight. It's over, back off. That they banged wheels means that the stewards are probably duty bound to investigate the incident because there's contact, but Leclerc will always say, well, where am I supposed to go? I can't disappear, we banged front wheels. But probably on the balance you would say, well, the position was gone, mate. You should have looked to cut back underneath and overtake him on the exit, not try to hang on.
Yeah, when you watch the replay and you see the extent to which Max has already executed the manoeuvre completely before they get to the apex of the corner, and Charles has seen it and turned in really quite sharply, it's game over.
Yeah.
It is completely game over. And there was no point in trying to hang around the outside on that, because it was there for everyone to see that what Max was not going to...
He's not going to give him the... Yeah,
he was basically fishing for a penalty, which...
It's live by the sword, die by the sword, as
Ed Straw
would say. Yeah, on the outside. Essentially, Max did to Leclerc what Rosberg tried to do to Lewis in 2016 when they clashed there, but he just executed it properly and gave the correct amount of space on the way in, which Nico didn't quite manage to do.
Now, Mark, you mentioned football having one referee, not strictly accurate anymore, because
VAR.
We have VAR, which is something that we didn't have room for in the 600 odd words that fit on the back page of F1 Racing.
Isn't economists moaning that they don't have enough
enough space? We'll be appearing in the Bananarama 12-inch remix on autosport.com when that one goes up. I do mention VAR in it, along with various other refereeing aids that have come into other sports. So you look at things that have been brought in to help referees with mixed results. So in tennis, you have Hawkeye, which is very popular, but it's something that the contestant, or a player rather, can only call on a limited number of times. So it's not allowed to slow the game down. Cricket has a similar system, once again, that helps but doesn't intrude. In rugby, you have the television match official, which is colossally polarising. Crowds don't like the way everything stops. Sometimes the referee doesn't go to the third match official. Sometimes they do. Sometimes they overturn their decisions. It can be quite farcical. And then in football, you have VAR, which has been adopted.
It's new, isn't it?
You know, the football's governing body, to my understanding, I'm not a massive football fan, has really dragged its heels with the introduction of that, but it was fans and stakeholders alike, rather like in Formula One, fans and stakeholders wanting that strict interpretation of the rules. People screamed for VAR because they thought they'd been robbed of results. Now you have people wanting it to be taken away again because it doesn't deliver the result they want. So it's become farcical.
Well, also because it interrupts the flow of the game. So the sports you mentioned where video umpiring or refereeing works quite well are games where you've got natural stop and start within a normal process. So cricket, you know, you bowl, the batsman tries to hit the ball, and then there's a break before the next delivery, or if it's an over, the next over. In rugby, it's a territorial game, isn't it? You kick the ball out of play deliberately to try and gain yards. So there's always a stop start and a point at which then you can refer dodgy decisions upstairs without really interrupting the normal pattern. But in football, there's okay, the ball goes out, but that's normally something you don't want to happen. So there's more of a natural flow to the game that if you start then interrupting the game to review incidents, you lose that rhythm. And I think Formula One has the same problem multiplied, because the race starts, and until the race finishes, something is always happening that's part of the natural flow. You've got pit stops, but the race doesn't stop for people to go into the pits. They're continually racing until the checkered flag. So how do you bring in a system that requires you to stop everything and then review something that's happened? You can't really do it live. So you have stewards either making decisions under pressure in the heat of the moment. The trouble with that is, as we see in Canada, whether you agree with it or not, it's already affected the outcome. You can't take it back once you've applied the 5 seconds. There's no disclaimer in the rules that allows them to rescind the penalty. So the only way you can really do things, I think, fairly, is review incidents later. Like, okay, in the Max and Charles Leclerc case, it's on the last lap, so there's no time to react. And people will complain, oh, well, it's, you know, the result's not confirmed for 3 hours after the race, but you need to go make sure you get the decision right, don't you? And there's no way to interrupt Formula One to get that decision right live.
Well, I do think the drivers need to, between themselves, work out what it is they want. Do they want to sit in the steward's office for 4 hours after a race debating the ins and outs of what happened between two of them? Because at the end of the day, they're the drivers. They make the decisions. Or do they want to just say, you know what, once those lights go out, we're going to fight between ourselves. It's a duel to the end of the race. Sometimes you'll win it, sometimes you'll lose it. Charles Leclerc, fantastic young driver, setting the sport on fire, really, in so many ways, thankfully, at Ferrari. And yet his instinctive reaction on banging wheels is get on the radio, complain, see if we can get a penalty going here. Is that what the drivers really want? Do they want to win and lose races depending on how much they shout down the radio to get a penalty? Or do they, or should it not be the case that when you bang wheels with someone and you end up being overtaken, you know that the best way is just to come back and overtake them and race? Let's just let the racing do the talking instead of radio communications with your engineer to whinge about it.
You can't, the thing is, you can never win either way, can you? If you have a system where the rules are, let's say, fast and loose, or it's a bit more Wild West, then you rely on the drivers having a kind of informal code of conduct among themselves and all knowing what the acceptable limit is. And I'm sure in the earlier days of Formula One, where it was much more dangerous, you had that because you knew if you banged wheels, you could potentially kill not only your opponent, but yourself. But in the modern era, and the likes of Senna, who you wrote about in your column previously, and Schumacher, you know, they pushed the envelope of what was acceptable etiquette on track. You got these late lunges, you got these chops of squeezing drivers at the start into pit walls and what have you, or off the track. So suddenly the code of conduct is disappeared because of safety and the desire to win at all costs. So therefore, at that point, regulation has to step in because you need someone independently to say that is acceptable, that isn't, this is the line. And that's fine, that calms things down, except that, of course, the consequence of that is that you'll get people trying to exploit the rules. So we've seen Max Verstappen come into Formula One and he has just tried to go absolutely up to that limit and ask a question of the rule book. He's like, okay, I'm going to do this under braking, and I'm going to dare you to say that it's not acceptable, and then they have to change the rule. Okay, I don't do that anymore. Well, now if I know I've got to give a car's width when I do this, but what about when I'm here? Is that acceptable or not? You just have to take that rough with the smooth of an approach that protects the drivers from themselves.
Mark, earlier you said there should be fewer stewards, like maybe one. Is that a practicable thing? And should we maybe, if we were to do that, should it be a permanent steward if someone like Max is from race to race asking questions? Would it help with consistency if we had maybe a smaller pool of people?
I think it would add enormously to the spectacle if there was a noteworthy referee that could even talk to the media, and you know, there'd be this go-to person, man or woman. Maybe there'd be a pool of professional referees, so you'd have the referee that everyone likes, you'd have the referee that everyone thinks, oh god, he always,
yeah, the referee's got it in for Max, the referee's got it in for Lewis.
And it would add something to, I mean, fundamentally decision by committee. You know, look at Emanuele Pirro. I mean, he must have had such a horrendous experience after the Canadian Grand Prix. He was being trolled online, people calling him all these names. Emanuele Pirro is a phenomenal guy and a great racing driver, and exactly to your point, Ben, all they did was apply the rules. And but the referee I sometimes think, you know, for a sport that ought to question everything in the modern era, because everything has changed, technology has changed, risk has changed, so many things have changed, so therefore we should question everything in terms of the way the sport is run. And you know, I think you know, dare I mention his name again, just because of his passing this year, but a Charlie Whiting type character, you know, someone who's broad shoulders and a huge amount of experience, you can just say, actually, that was wrong, I'm calling it out, I'll stand over it.
And he would do that on the technical side, wouldn't he? You know, yeah. Issuing his TD updates to the team, saying, look, okay, we're not saying this is not allowed, but if you do this, it's going to cause a stink, so don't do it.
I mean, at Cosworth,
and he was well respected. You need, for consistency, it makes sense to have one person who adjudicates.
Yeah.
Because then you know, even if you don't like the way they do it, they're going to be consistent. Absolutely. With themselves. And that is all really the competitors want, is consistency. But it is very difficult because, as you mentioned, the plates are constantly shifting, aren't they?
I mean, when I was at Cosworth, there was an engine freeze on the V8 engine, so no development was allowed. Unless you wanted to develop something, in which case you basically submitted to the FIA a paper that would say, we've got a reliability problem.
Absolutely, yeah.
And the FIA would look at it, Charlie, and they would say, oh, you know, okay, well, obviously, for reliability reasons, you should be allowed to fix that. So they'd go away and develop it. And I remember on one occasion, Ferrari suddenly announced that they were having major valve reliability issues. And the only way to solve it was to design a new sodium-filled valve, which, you know, by the way, happened to be a much more efficient and temperature consistent way of valve operation. And it was sent to Renault, and it was sent to Cosworth, sent to Mercedes. And I remember getting on the phone to Charlie Whiting and saying, this is absolutely outrageous. And, you know, and Charlie said, well, have you seen the photographs that they've submitted of all the broken valves? And I said, yeah, absolutely. I've had a look at those. And he said, well, there's nothing we can do about it. He said, you know, he said, Mark, if you want to develop something, go and break it on the dyno.
Show us the evidence and off you
show
go.
Show us the evidence and off you go. And you know, it was a very practical conversation, and he was saying, look, we know what they're doing. Actually, it's not for us to say that their valves are not failing. They seem to have a problem with it, so we're going to let them do the development. So it was very pragmatic, and I know if I'd gone, and as subsequently happened, you know, I was able to go to Charlie with other things and say, this is what we want to do. So when the hot blown diffuser technology came in, we also had a few things that we needed to develop for the engine to survive under those conditions. And he was fine about it. So it worked for everyone.
Yeah. The rules will always be bent, won't they, by people who need,
a bit
need
like
to
valves.
Succeed. Yeah, exactly. You know, that's just the nature of the game. You can't, in that instance, you really can't solve that conundrum because reliability and performance are connected. So you either have an absolute, there is nothing, you're not allowed to do anything, it's a complete freeze, but then you will have, as a unintended consequence, sure, failures that then you can't fix, which yep, will make people angry. Or you can have no rules in the case of the drivers, but then you rely on them self-policing, and there will always be people who won't self-police and will try and get away with things they shouldn't be allowed to get away with. So yeah, you just, we are destined to endlessly repeat this loop.
Well, you know, that's the thing with history, isn't it? You're condemned to repeat it if you don't understand the lessons. Unfortunately, our colleagues on Autosport are going to bend a few valves in their cylinder head if we don't give up the studio so they can do some filming in just a second. So it is time for me to thank my guests, Ben Anderson and Mark Gallagher.
Thank you, Codders.
Thank you very much.
It has been a joy. We will reconvene in a few weeks for the next episode of Flat Chat with me, Stuart Codling. Now, before we disappear, I have to say one last thing, which is the latest subscription offer is you can try 3 issues of F1 Racing for £5. A princely sum. Keep us in business. Keep our mortgages paid. Keep yourselves entertained. And the subject of Formula One, go to www.autosportmedia.com/offer/F1 2019 to avail yourselves of that offer. We will see you again in just a few weeks.